So today we begin our third meditation on Paul, having done Galatians. Then we got Paul all the way to Corinth, and then we took him to Ephesus, and from Ephesus he wrote, I suggest to you anyhow, quite possibly three letters. One of them was the first one, just across the Aegean to Corinth, and a second one is the one we're moving on to today, which is the letter to the Colossians. There are people who argue, and their arguments are based on content, theology, and on style, and it's almost taken for granted in many commentaries, because they repeat each other naturally, that this is a post-Pauline book, not a letter not written by Paul. The arguments that I give for it being Paul are in my commentary, and I can't go into it today, but I think there are, of course, scholars that say it is Paul. They're in a minority, but their arguments are far better. So I'm taking it as a Pauline letter, and I think it's written from Corinth in the year 54 AD. And the text that I'm going to focus on is, clothe yourselves with love, which binds everything together in perfect harmony. So the topic, we've looked at freedom, we've looked at the gifts, everyone's gift being needed, now we're looking at love. The subtitle of my lecture is, no one will listen to our proclaiming the good news unless they see, and I've added, and feel love. I might be wrong. In my training, I was trained as a missionary of the Sacred Heart, so that was all good. But on the intellectual level and in the system that I went through, and I'm telling you this because this would be every priest who's my age and a bit younger probably, feelings were really not considered, I have to say. It was the intellectual. We had a great education intellectually, philosophy and so on, but feelings were not, you didn't worry about your feelings and you didn't follow them and they weren't that important. That's the feeling that I got, That's the impression that I got anyhow. And possibly that has a little bit to do with celibacy, training us to be self-reliant and not dream too much of possibilities, or mightn't work for you. If so, it's a very bad training for celibacy, which we'd all see today. And that may not be the reason, but it wasn't really very much encouraged. But life teaches me, and it must have taught all you forever, that feelings are actually terrifically important. You don't need to follow them, that's of course, but they're signs. They're like a little red light on the dashboard that might tell you, if they still do that, that you're running out of oil or something. Feelings have to be listened to and honoured, really, and not put down, because if we repress them, you know what happens. And people often come to reconciliation and say they felt angry, and as though that was a sin. Feeling angry isn't a sin. What you do when you feel angry might be. Your actions, your words, but the feeling is telling you something, and you've got to honour it. So I'm suggesting that if people don't actually see love in the community, well, then all the talk about the community and what a love, or they know we are Christians by our love, doesn't mean anything much. And I actually think you have to feel love to see it. It has to be something that connects and engages you, not just on the intellectual level of theory, but on the deep level of human response. So with that in mind, that's what I'm hoping to talk about with you today. We don't have to move geographically, because we did Corinthians last week, and we were in Ephesus here, writing across to Corinth. Well, there's Colossae, just out there. And it's from the same situation, so I'll read to you the situation where I suggest Paul wrote from, Acts 19:8-10. Paul entered the synagogue in Ephesus and for 3 months spoke out boldly and argued persuasively about the kingdom of God. when some stubbornly refused to believe and spoke evil of the way, which was one of the early words used for the church, the way, Tao, in the same, often religions use that word of what they are, before the congregation, he left them, taking the disciples with him, and he argued daily in the lecture hall of Tyrannus. This continued for 2 years, so that all the residents of Asia, that's that whole province of Rome in western Turkey, all the residents of Asia, both Jews and Greeks, heard the word of the Lord. So I'm suggesting to you, Paul never actually went to Colossae, but a man called Epaphras did. And it's likely that Epaphras was a student of Paul here, and that would have happened in a lot of places. People learning, excited by it, moved by it, went out and told their people and did it that way. So here's Paul writing a letter to that church that he hadn't visited personally. And in chapter 1, verse 4 to 5, he writes, "We've heard of your faith in Christ Jesus, the love that you have for all the saints, because of the hope laid up for you in heaven." And you might have noticed last Sunday where the reading was the first letter to the Thessalonians, in the early verses, talks about faith, hope, and love. Here it is here. It's common in Paul to refer to the three, we've now picked them up as the three theological virtues, the virtues that relate not to moral behavior, but attach us to God. Faith, openness to grace, being open to the mystery of the sacred. Love, the commitment of oneself to God and to the community. Seek first the kingdom of God. It's a choice that we make. And hope is that thinking of the future and relating the future to, leaving the future in the hands of God in trust so that we can focus on the present moment. So he's heard about that. Heard about it because he's never visited them. It's come by repute. A little later, in chapter 3, verse 12 to 14, we have this absolutely glorious passage. "As God's chosen ones, holy and beloved, clothe yourself with compassion, kindness, humility, meekness, and patience." Clothe yourself. You remember that gospel we had a couple of weeks ago of the man who was in the marriage feast, and one of them didn't have a marriage garment on and was sent out. Now that's looking at the practice of the day, but leaving that aside, the practice of the day, we've got the reason Jesus is using that is that, of course, if you are at a wedding banquet, you have to put on Christ. Clothe yourself. Here it is here. If a person's life is not clothed with compassion, kindness, humility, meekness, and patience, increasingly, then something radically is going wrong, and you're not really celebrating the Lord's Supper, because that's the natural effect of it. So you are chosen, so clothe yourself with these. "Now bear with one another, and if anyone has a complaint against another, forgive each other." Forgive, beautiful word. Here means to give for. To give yourself for another. Forgiving when it's just a decision saying, "I forgive you." If you don't give yourself for the other person, you're not forgiving them. It's just a word, really. So to give yourself there for them. "Just as the Lord has forgiven you, given himself for you, so you also must forgive." And here we come to our topic. Above all, clothe yourself with love, which binds everything together in perfect harmony. So now I indulge in a little bit of psychology, which could be unwise, could be wise. It's up to you to know what you know about. See if this is true for you. Obviously, I think it is, but that doesn't make it true. So we're moving away from a theological examination now to something in the realm of psychology. So everyone's got something to offer in this. This is my offering, and you check it. Being loved is essential for a true sense and appreciation of one's uniquely lovable self. Therefore, for one's ability to love your neighbour as yourself. It would be pretty universal, maybe totally universal, that if a person doesn't love themselves, they actually can't love others. That's the key problem in there, is love of self. And we have to look at what that means. And that's learned only by someone loving you. So I don't know what happens if no one's ever loved a person. I can't work that out, really, because I was loved by my mum and dad and other people. But it just seems... that's why Jesus says, love one another as I've loved you, because if there's no love in a person's life, put some there, and then they're loved. And then they've got a chance to move on. So it's essential to be able to love your neighbour as yourself, to be able to love yourself. Which means it's essential to be loved so that you can do that. Now, is this right or wrong? I'll do my best. Love communion with the mother is the basis of my consciousness of myself as desired, loved and good. That relationship, I think, between a child and a mother is totally irreplaceable. And it's the key in our development of our psyche, this total motherly love. That's the basis of learning who I am. So that if my mother really was unable to love me very much because of, it could be psychological problems, it could be pressure, it could be a husband who mistreats, there could be thousands of reasons. She might be doing her best, but she's not able to love me very much, then not being loved, looking for love, missing it, not knowing what's happening, will leave me in a difficult situation. And I'll have to, there'll be a lot of learning through my life to somehow overcome that. So all I'm, not without putting pressure on mum, I hope, this is a key to the development of the psyche of the person. However, if you'd accept that as reasonably true, second point is that we have to grow beyond knowing ourselves as loved by my mother. I have to grow beyond that, for I have to experience myself as lovable, desirable, because I'm me. Not just because I'm my mother's child. And some people, there can be difficulties there too. A mother can actually attach herself to the child and not let the child go, because the mum loves to be loved by the child. So that can be a hook that people have to carry through life, a difficult situation for a person to grow free of it. So, I think this is correct. Number three, I need my mother to stay with me, to love me, to encourage me, and to protect me as I explore beyond communion with her. And you're seeing it all the time. You mums have had to do this, so you'd know. The little child has to grow away from mum. Not entirely from mum, but from the hooked connection with mum. Has to find my way to see that I'm loved because I'm me, not my mother's child. So I need to experience that her love is not dependent on my clinging to her. I mustn't get the feeling that if you don't cling to me, you're not lovable. I've got to see that. And neither is my sense of self as love dependent on clinging to mum. And don't you see it all the time? You see the little child working its way away, but not too far, and then it comes back, and then it works its way away, and then it comes back, and it's all very brave, and then it goes back. And that's all lovely, as long as the mother is wanting the child to go further and further away. Do you know what I mean? I don't mean lost, but finding itself and enjoying the child learning independence and so on. And if the mother can love me while I'm doing that, that's a wonderful gift to help me realize that we can discover that our being loved is not dependent on I must keep loving my mother and that. I'm game to try this, aren't I? But anyway, you'll forgive me and shoot me down later, I guess. To love someone is to see their true beauty, to believe in them. And there's the word, it's a good English word, to believe. If you know a little bit of Dutch, liefde, believe means to be in love. That's what the word actually means. Leave, love, it's the same word. To believe is to be in love with. To believe in God is to be in that love of God, to live there. So we have to, when we learn to believe in people, it's a great gift, isn't it, if someone believes in you. That's what they're doing, they're loving you. And to relate to them in such a way as to bring out their true beauty. And somehow to know that your mother's key, of course your father becomes key in, and I won't go into all that because it's too much for our talk, but the mother is basic and then the father comes in and there's complications there, but that's really vital to the growth of the girl or the boy, as we know, all of that. But we eventually have to find who we are as loved. And if a parent can love me whatever I do, and most parents, I think, do that, it's a beautiful gift. Because then I know I've got, like the prodigal son, I can go home and be loved. They don't like everything I do and they don't pretend and they say, well, in our home, this is what you behave while you're here at home, this is what we do. And that's presumably good to do that, to have boundaries. We all need them. But what if I break the boundaries? I won't ever feel that I'm not loved. I'm disapproved of, I'm corrected, but I'm not loved. So that is there. And I've got that in brackets, Michelangelo and David, because I just love the story that I read years ago. I think it was in that book called Agony and Ecstasy, the novel written about Michelangelo. And in Florence, where he was working at the time, in the one of the backyards, they had this hunk of marble that had been badly chipped and shaped and whatever, broken, I suppose, in parts. So it was so shaped, it was beautiful Carrara marble, perfect white and, you know, the best marble you can get. But the shape of it was so awkward, no one could do anything with it. And it was there for years. And the story that I read was that Michelangelo kept looking at it and looking at it and looking at it because it was there to be used if you could do it. And then one day he saw David in it. He saw, and then his art, of course, beautiful, is to chip away everything that stops David appearing, what you're doing when you work with marble. And so we've got one of the masterpieces of the world. And if you look at it carefully, you'll see the angles of the hips and everything are really quite awkward. They're brilliant, but it took a genius to do it. But what I'm saying really is that Michelangelo saw David in the marble. And I presume you parents and grandparents and aunties and uncles and everything else, that's a loving thing to do. You see in the child or in the young person something they don't see themselves. And you've got to love them and do all you can because you know them better than they know themselves, really. And they're caught up in this peer group pressure and media pressure, which has got no concern for them as people, mostly. And yet you've got this parental love. So to bring out their true beauty is a wonderful thing to do. So this love that we're receiving, which is what I'm talking about, awakens in the person in me, in you, a desire to be in communion with the person that loves you. It's hard to resist love. Someone loves you, well, you want to respond and you want to be in their presence, and it's a joy and all that, of course. Indirectly, this awakening of desire awakens the feeling that I am desirable. I think this is the way it works, that my desire for you, whoever you be, mother, father, friend, lover, you know, the person that somehow sees you and you can sense it, that awakens in me a desire to be with you at whatever level is appropriate and so on. And that awakening of the desire has the effect of my thinking that I'm actually desirable, lovable. I think it works, in a sense, indirectly. This being loved by another is a sacrament of the love that is God, and awakens a sense of being unconditionally loved. Now, unconditional love is something beyond anything we can experience. I presume every parent and every friend and everybody, unconditional love is the goal, but it's really divine, and we tend to fall short of it only because we're human beings. But this awakens in us this sense of that, and the religious experience is the experience of being loved unconditionally because I'm me. And in a way, I don't think that can be anything but a religious experience. This is a religious experience in which everything comes together, and the one loved experiences a belonging that is not limited to the current experience. It's a belonging to the universe, a belonging to God. I experienced this once only, really, that's a bit exaggerated, but when I was a seminarian, I'll just explain to you this little experience I had. I was 20, I suppose, 19 or 20, something like that. And I'd go to the classroom, would have as many people as this in it, 40, 50 students. And we're in different years, they did it in blocks. So you kind of circled in what you did, because they didn't have time to teach every little group. There was 8 in our class and 5 in the one ahead, and then 15 in the one ahead of that kind of thing. So I put all that together. So we've got this group going. So you could sit behind a desk and you could read what you're interested in under the desk without being rude, because the teacher wouldn't necessarily notice. They might have noticed more than we thought. So I was reading a book in French called The Participation in the Being of God, because I was puzzled, as you all would be, in how there's only one God, and you can't add anything to God, or God becomes finite. You can't have God plus anything. So therefore, in a philosophical sense, everything is part of God. The trees and the weather and me and you, and we're all in the mystery somehow. But we're not God. So it's what the technical term is, the participation in the being of God. We participate in God's being, and the images are used, like the rays of light from the sun are part of the sun. You know, they're not but they're not the sun, you know, and all that. So you could go on and on and on. And we're dealing with mysterious stuff here, but important stuff. So anyhow, that was fascinating to me. So I read it in every class, really, and keep one ear cocked so that you could pass exams and answer a question if it was addressed to you, and that, I found that fairly easy to do. Men can only usually do one thing at a time, I know, but I've got this well-developed feminine side, so I was able to organise. But then one day in the cold of winter, I was out sitting under a tulip tree reading this stuff, and if you read a thing a lot and it's really engaging all your psyche, and I was sitting under this tulip tree, which was bare because it's winter. And all I can tell you is that I had this experience of belonging to the tree, and the tree was reaching up to the stars. It was perfect starlight night, nothing to stop the stars, because it wasn't in the middle of the city or anything. And I just remember belonging to the tree, belonging to the stars, belonging to the universe, part of it. And that was 50-something years ago. And I've never forgotten it, and it's still there. You know, it's like it's just one of those privileged... But I bet in different ways you've all had different things like that. I hope you have anyhow. But this is the belonging thing. So I've never doubted that I belong to the world. The world's fine, and I'm part of it, you know. And it's a great feeling, because not everyone knows that. But thank God I do. So with the awakening of self-awareness, we experience a radical ambivalence, however, I suggest to you. The person who loves us and the purity of their love are vital ingredients in how I handle this ambivalence, which I'm about to talk to you about. There's a kind of a two-way thing happening when you become aware of yourself. So it's great if you've got saints for parents or grandparents. I don't know what my grandparents were like, but my parents were pretty good. And so isn't that a good fortune? This is the ambivalence. See if you think it's right. We want to feel good. So, to feel good, we tend to cling to and reinforce the social context in which we've learnt that we're loved. So if you're loved by a Christian right-wing, red-necked buddy father who is against everything that's not white and Protestant and I don't know what, you know what I mean? If that's the kind, or if that's the kind of father you have, and he really loves you, and he goes everywhere with you, and he gives you everything you want, and he does care about you, can't you see that it's likely that you'll be a redneck? You know, that's the way it works. So all the biases and prejudices of your family. I grew up as a Catholic. Well, how would I ever be anything else with my parents and the church and the music and the and the whole thing? Now, with time, it's become intellectually convincing to me, so I'm not struggling with it. I can't think of being anything else. But you know what I mean? It would be hard to be. When people actually move from one to another, that's a massive move, isn't it? Because you're moving away from family and culture and what your family thought was important. And that must, I've never had to do that and have never thought of doing it. Never been tempted to do it. But some don't do it, and I think that's massive for this reason. The prejudices and biases of your family, culture, race, nation, and creed. And just look at the ex-Yugoslavia to see that. I mean, it's massive, isn't it? How difficult it is. Or look at what used to be Northern and Southern Ireland. It seems to be better now, I don't know. These things are hard to dig out. And this binds us, this tendency to want to continue being loved by the ones that love you who are like this and engender these thoughts in your head, this binds us to what we call original sin, which means the sins of our origins. Don't think of Adam and Eve, or if you do, realize it's just a story about you and your husband and your wife and your parents and your kids. It's a story about life. So they're not people, they're stage characters that are really about every man and every woman. So that's all right. So your sins of your origins, you've picked up not only through your chromosomes and everything from dad and grandpa and the throwbacks that come into us, but also the whole environment of your childhood has a big effect. It acts as a resistance to the impulse of God's Spirit. Look at the contemporaries of Jesus, the Pharisees. Paul made a dramatic, powerful breakthrough, but nearly everyone else didn't. Oh no, you can't do that. You've got to cop follow the law. God says in Leviticus this, so you've got to do it. You've got to be a Jew. You just get me? You've got all that stuff coming. Most stayed within it, and that's what most of us do, sadly. The resistance to the impulse of God's Spirit, which is calling us and gracing us to grow into who we really are. I'm not my father. My father got there for a whole lot of reasons, whatever. Might have been, I'm going back to that image I'm giving you, but my father might be an Olympic swimmer and he's got me in the pool when I'm about 4 months old, paddling away and going like mad because he got the silver and he's determined for me to get the gold. But he's never had a good look at me. I'm male, all right, but I'm actually absolutely like my mother. I'm artistic and I'm this and I'm that, and swimming is not my thing. I haven't got the body for it, you know. I haven't got the. But Dad doesn't see that because he. But I'm not Dad, so I have to find myself sometime, don't I? Someone has to help me break away from the whatever it is. Now, this freedom to find me, has its fears. So we can opt for inertia. People stay in marriages sometimes out of inertia. They've never been alone. And the thought of being alone is so hard, they'll stay in an abusive situation. And that's tragic, and the community has to somehow do something about that, because how do you suddenly go out there on your own when you've never done it before? When we experience dislocation in our being loved, something goes wrong. Someone dies who loves you very much and they're gone. They're not there to love you anymore. Or you suddenly find out there's something more to it or whatever. We're necessarily disappointed, of course. And sin enters when we take this dislocation to be all there is, not trusting our primary awareness and our desire. Then we can spiral into a depression or anything, because the dislocation is so massive for us that we hook into it and stop believing in this God-given longing and desire to be loved. That's one. At the same time, and this is the dichotomy we face, we hunger and thirst to live and to live to the full. Everyone wants to do it. You all want to do it. I want to do it. And we sense that we're made, Augustine, we're made for God, and our heart is restless till we rest in God. We actually all know we belong to the universe. Deep down, I mean. We all know that we're part of this. We know that we're lovable. Something in us knows it. And we've got to keep believing in that. We long to be free, to be captivated by grace. And that's hard in a secular environment, a secular education. Secular's good, but I mean by secular when it is not open to the mystery of the divine. It locks itself in somewhere. Essentially, self-awareness is an affirmation of the self. I have a basic awareness that I am desirable and good. If others love me poorly, or if I don't resist the temptation to avoid freedom, if I want to stay inside the cage, and someone opens the cage door, sometimes it happens in our life, and we get to the edge of the cage, and we peep out, and then we see a snake and a cat and a hawk. And we look outside the cage and then we think, so we go, get onto the perch and go make our little noises, and then we get fed and watered till one day we actually die, never having flown. Hope this isn't too cruel, is it? Am I being too cruel? The temptation to avoid freedom, I'm likely to nurture a distorted image of myself. This is a really great big problem in the community. A distorted image of myself, a poor self-image. In fact, it's almost universal. So if you feel like this, don't put yourself down. It's pretty hard to avoid this somehow. Most people have it, in my view. Or an inflated self-image. You had the doting mother who clung to you, and you clung to her, and you lived with her for a long time, and that went on and on and on, and she thought you were absolutely marvellous, and you wonder why the rest of the world doesn't think you're marvellous. They don't even bother to talk to you, or they walk past you in the street, but you're... And people do have this, I don't know how common it is, but an unreal self-image, and that's why dear parents and grandparents and priests... Don't flatter anyone, ever. Don't tell me I'm good at something if I'm not. Don't tell a child, you'll make a ballerina if she's... Don't do it, because the poor little kid will wonder one day when she thinks she's the greatest little dancer in the world, and she'll go and they won't elect her, they won't have her in, the other kids will laugh at her. She'll get, you know what I'm saying, don't you? So don't tell a person that they've got a wonderful soprano voice if it's like the croak of some beetle that's gone distraught out the backyard. Find the person, be like Michelangelo. Look and look and look and look till you see the gift, because everyone's got a beautiful gift. It doesn't matter what it is. Find it, encourage it, love the real person into life, or you're heading them for a terrible disappointments because their self-image has been put on them by you, the one who loves them, and it's not them. So it's... Anyway, God, I'm sounding like a... Oh. Well, you know I'm not a parent, so you'll allow me to waffle on, but... I'm now going to be quoting from this book here, which is excellent. Let this mind be in you. It's called The Quest for Identity Through Oedipus to Christ. There's a lot of... It's by Sebastian Moore, M-O-O-R-E, Benedictine. Still alive, though he's 90-something now. And he says a couple of quotes from that book. As my basic awareness of myself grounds all that I come to know, so my basic love of myself grounds all that I come to want. I like that. You see, if you love yourself, you won't be proud. It's got nothing to do with pride or all the rest of it. That all comes from false self-images. Love of self is a healthy thing to do. Then you can be yourself. To the extent that I love myself, I don't have to put on a show for you. I don't have to, everyone. I don't have to kind of appear good, or I don't have to go spiralling into, if you think my homily is a crook, well, they probably are. Sometimes, and they don't meet every... Do you know what I mean? It's not a big issue, really. You do your best. But you can be yourself doing your best. Does that make sense? So being yourself doing your best is all you can do, because it's worth doing, being yourself, and you don't change yourself to fit in with people's expectations or to appeal to people or make them think you're good, because none of that actually matters if you know that you basically are good. So just be who you are. And if you're in an orchestra and you're playing a piccolo... And you're envious of the bloke who's, or the person who's playing the tuba, you know. Well, you're a piccolo. What's wrong with a piccolo? I mean, I don't know why anyone would particularly want to play you if you're piccolo, but I suppose there must be people who are experts in piccolos and things. And there's got to be a place for them. But there's a place for you and me too, and there's a place for the widow's mite, and there's a place for everybody. There's a place for every flower in the garden. So don't let's be envious or jealous, or just be, because you are beautiful. Well, you wouldn't exist if you weren't. So somehow we've got to help our children know that, our teenagers know that, and our old people know it, and which includes all of us. So there's a real danger that the spontaneous, first-hand, feeling response that we have is replaced by an internalized self-image of myself as the object of another's love. So you see yourself as a wife, a husband, a mother, a priest, a bachelor, a nurse. Nothing wrong with any of these particularly, but they're not getting anywhere near the reality. You have to see yourself as you, as me, who is doing these things. But if you suddenly stop nursing, you don't lose your identity. You don't express it that way. And if you lose your partner in life, you're still you. You're no less lovable. Do you know what I mean? Or if I lose the priesthood, which I thought I would lose once, but anyhow, I don't have to go into that with you, I'm still me. So can't I do something else? Can't I give lectures on Paul without being... What I mean is, we have to trust that we are lovable. Then, yeah. It's important that our affirmation of another be a response to their real selves. I think I've said that. That's why flattery is... Don't ever do it. Say nothing or say something beautiful about someone, but there's no other thing else to do. Otherwise, we can develop an expectation that's out of touch with what people actually feel me to be. We've got an image of ourselves, and everyone who knows this knows it's not me. Now, I don't know about me, you'd have to tell me, but I know with other people, I see them acting. I see them brittle, tough, and they're as weak as water. Like, they're good, they're soft. But they put on this... we had a Butte priest in our order who was a bit like that. And some people used to fear him, and I don't know why, so anyhow. But I knew what he was like on the inside. It never worried me what he was putting on the show. And we were great friends. Because I suppose I didn't threaten, I don't know what. But I used to be sad, but when I thought he'd, you know, other people thought he was authoritarian and strong and tough, and he was as soft as butter, really. So I could actually do anything with him. No, I don't mean that. I mean, it was... Do you know what I'm trying to say? You just got to see the person, and I don't know why we don't, but... I don't know why I don't, but... Though this highlights the truth, that to truly love another is to want them to be their unique self. You mustn't want your children to be like you. I presume you don't. You want them to find who they are, because you know that who they are is incredibly beautiful. God created this beautiful human being, so. Not to bind them to me, whoever me is, in such a way as to make them feel that if they don't belong to me, the love communion with us will be broken. If you don't do what I tell you, that's the end of it. Or if you don't love me, yeah, no, let them. Let us all be who we are. So, here we come up against the environmental as distinct from the hereditary dimension of what we call original sin. There's a constant danger that society will reinforce in us the need to see ourselves as others see us, or as others tell me we're seen. If I'm wrong on this, I might be, but I think the whole media, advertising media, depends on this. You have, if you're a woman, for God's sake, you've got to be able to be... If you don't give splinters to someone who hugs you, you're not a woman. You've got to be as thin, as thin, as thin. And if you can't walk along the catwalk and look beautiful, God, it must be just dreadful. Anyhow... But there's a bit of pressure on that, or there used to be. We're getting more sensible, aren't we? So a girl, a woman, who's got a different biology and different mechanisms than that and has got a little bit of stuff that's worth hugging, will think she's not very beautiful because she's size, whatever sizes are. I don't know anything about it, thank God. But we live... Or what's a priest supposed to be? Or what's a mother supposed to be? Or what do you need in life? And you need this, and you have to have that, and you've got to have this, and you have to, each of your kids has to have a room of their own, or you're not a good parent. And they've got to have their own TV, or you're not being a very good parent. We had two bedrooms in our home, and I can't go back, and I'm not so, but it was good. We had two bedrooms in our home. Mum and Dad were in one, my two sisters were in the other, and there was no other bedroom in the house, and there were six boys. Work out where we slept. Work out how many private rooms we had. Work out... But we had each other, for God's sake, and we belted each other into shape, and I reckon I'm okay. No. So, you know, there's something about this society we're in that's making it hard for you, because for everybody to do it. Sebastian Moore writes, so how other people... We don't... How other people see us is their problem, in a way. Who we are, is it? And if they don't see you for who you are, they do have a problem. Leave it with them. Now, that's a bit hard and a bit simplistic, but we've got to find ourselves. And this is why when we say at baptism we're freed from original sin, of course we're still in it, we're still in the real world, but we're not locked into it anymore, please God, because the sacrament of baptism is a welcoming into a community that'll love you. That's what it is. If it's not that, it's rubbish and don't bother with it. It's nothing. But this is a community of love that you, and people are going to tell you about Jesus, and they're going to invite you to First Communion. They're going to be happy when you do this and do that, and they're going to tell you that you can sin and be reconciled. We've got this wonderful thing going, and that's what we're welcoming people into. And in other words, Jesus is present embracing the children, and he says, don't stop them, let them come to me. That's what we're doing when we baptize. So we're freeing people from being locked into this environmental and hereditary stuff. We're giving them an alternative. We're taking them from the kingdom of darkness, as we say, into the kingdom of light. Well, let's make sure it is a kingdom of light. They may choose not to live in the light. That's everyone's choice, but we've got to try and make it that. And Moore writes, it's always some often subtle self-rejection that hinders us from believing in another finding us attractive and from seeing that the other does so when this happens. You get this as a priest a bit. I don't know for too much now, but maybe I noticed when I was a bit more immature, I don't know. But people would, you know, you'd see something in someone and you'd tell them, because that's what you do, and they'd say, oh yeah, but I'm not really like that. You're a priest, and you priests always say nice things. You know, that kind of thing. You're expected to say something complimentary. Well, I hope I never do that. I'm not aware of ever doing it, and I don't ever want to say something complimentary because you're expected to. But it's hard, people are so resistant to seeing their goodness that they shiver away from it and think, oh no, I'm not really, you know, it's common, it's normal, and we've got to love each other out of it. To the extent that other people's love encourages my dependence on them, my focus is on the attractiveness of the other person. This is vital stuff. You know, codependency, you'd all be aware of that. And in my job, and all of our jobs really as people, creating dependence is sadly not uncommon. And you can pick it. If someone is full of admiration for the person who loves them, there's nothing wrong with admiring the person who loves you, of course, but if that's their whole focus, my wife, how good she is to me, there's a problem in there. I mean, that would be beautiful to be able to say that. But if she's really loving me, what I should be relaxing into is thinking, I'm lovable. It's okay. It's okay to be me. And not admiring or putting on pedestals father or wife or husband or somebody else all on pedestals up there. Let's get into the real world and let's be together and let's relax into thinking that when someone loves us, they really do love us, and therefore we're lovable, and that will relax us back to be able to be a human being and to be able to love much better. To the extent that their love focuses on me and encourages interdependence, they're admiring me and I'm admiring them. My sense of being desirable is reinforced, and their love is helping me find my true self. And I hope it doesn't sound like it, but I assure you it's got nothing to do with pride here. It's a simple acceptance of my unique lovableness, and everybody needs to have that, so that we're not comparing and putting ourselves down or up. We don't need to do either. Moore writes, the vital centre of human relationships is arousal. This is the feeling stuff. The awakening of a person's sense of being desirable. He says, not, brackets, as commonly supposed, by another person desiring me, but by being aroused by another to desire. It's when you feel attracted to someone and desirous of them or want to be with them, that's the way that you become aware, if you think it through a bit or feel it through, that you're desirable, because you know what it is to desire. I'm not absolutely sure he's right there, but I think he is, and I offer it to you for your reflection. Sin is basically saying no to my true self. That's what we do when we sin. My good self. The cure is to experience myself as I am. And you are someone desired by God. That's ultimate, big statement, but it's true. So God desires you, so you must be quite special, and so must I. Again, Sebastian Moore, sin consists in treating a partial view of life as the whole. It's a refusal to grow. Paul makes a distinction regularly between the spirit and the flesh. And if it's misunderstood, it's disastrous. And a lot of denominations have radically in them this dichotomy. And it's a very sick dichotomy. It's not a dichotomy that Catholics have, and that's partly a bit of a problem too. Catholics dance, drink, take drugs, and fill up the jails, generally. That's all a bit humorous, but not too far from the... What I mean is, it is the Catholic feeling that everything's embraceable, you know. That's a very good feeling, and it gets abused, of course. The incarnation is what's central to Catholicism, that the matter matters, that the body is good, that sex is good, that the flesh is good, and that's very healthy, absolutely right. The trouble is we can abuse all those things such that anyone looking at it and looking at Jesus would pull away from it. So you can get sects that say, no, dancing is wrong, drinking is wrong, gambling is wrong, you know, like because of fear of the abuse. And that's very unhealthy in my view. And when you read Paul and you have the spirit and the flesh, they think of the flesh as the body, they think of the flesh as sex, perhaps, they think of the flesh. And so all these things become basically bad. You can allow them for certain reasons. If you're going to have a kid, you've got to have sex, so you put up with it. Or whatever word you... But it's kind of very wonky theology. And it's, when Paul talks about the flesh, he means me, all of me, which cuts off the spirit. That's what he means by flesh when he uses it in this dichotomy. But the flesh is good and it's meant to be open to the spirit. So you don't have the spirit separate from the flesh. It's the enspirited flesh. It's the body embracing the divine. It's the whole of everything about us is good. God saw that what he made, says Genesis, and he saw it was very good. So everything's very good. And when we abuse it, we don't stop the abuse by cutting it out. We purify it with the gift of God and learn to embrace the whole of our humanity because our whole humanity is very good. Most of that's been psychology rather than anything else, and you'll think about it and you'll get it off the net, and next week you're going to definitely have questions for me about it, I presume, when you've thought it through, and I hope to learn a lot from you when you do. But we look at Jesus' baptismal experience here and see the Jesus, God saying into Jesus, you are my beloved son, I love you, my favour rests on you. That was the experience of Jesus at the baptism as described. It's actually a quote from Isaiah 42, and there's a lot of theology in it, which I haven't got time to go into with you now. But it was Jesus feeling overwhelmed by love that took him into the desert and into the mission. So you have to be overwhelmed by love. The father of the two boys, beautiful parable of Jesus, the prodigal son often called. Notice how the father runs out to one boy, and then he runs out to the other one. He doesn't prefer one to the other. He just loves the boy that's come home, and he loves his elder son who's been working his heart out, whatever. It's a complicated parable. But the parable is basically directed against the older son. It's kind of trying to help the Pharisees. The prostitutes and sinners are coming to Jesus. That's marvelous. The Pharisees aren't. They've got the problem because they're not feeling love. They're not into life. They're into an intellectual hothouse or cold house, probably. And so the dad goes, and he says, come in, it's okay, it's your son, your brother, he's come home. Come and celebrate with us. And the end of the parable, we don't know whether he goes in or not. It's a wonderful parable, it's just a blank. And we don't know what he does, because it's an invitation for us to come in. If you want to, says the leper, you can heal me. He must have felt a very deep attraction to Jesus that made him know that this Jesus could heal him of his leprosy. Take it as symbolic for the moment. The leprosy that you and I have, the outsider, the one who doesn't belong, the one who doesn't fit in, the one who... There's a bit of all of us like that. And Jesus can heal that. Jesus, the bloke on the cross, for God's sake, he's made a mess of things. And he got caught anyhow. It's even making more of a mess of it. And he's dying on a cross. He's got about 5 minutes to live. So there's not going to be any great happy ending for this story. And he reaches across to Jesus and says, look, I don't know what you got, mate, but remember me when you come to your kingdom. I want to be part of it. And Jesus answers, you can't forget. Jesus said, well, how many times have you done it? And when did you last go to confession? And half an hour later, when they're both dead, the whole thing's sorted out. Jesus actually says, today you'll be with me in my kingdom. It's fairly human, isn't it? And then the woman caught in adultery. She must have got a heck of a shock. Things weren't going too well, and she was caught in the middle of it. Where the bloke went, nobody asks. Ah, come on, girls, slow down. So... we don't know, but she's there, chucked on the ground, and they're all certain, and they've got Jesus trapped, because if he says, don't stone her, he's disobeying God's will, as expressed in the Torah. It wasn't God's will, it was never God's will, but people thought it was God's will. The Old Testament is full of it, so is the church law full of it. We love making laws. We love it. I might try and think up one before you leave today just to kind of do my bit for the cause. But, you know, but we often get it wrong because we get God wrong and we get people wrong. And then Jesus says, you know, well, okay, if any of you haven't sinned since you're troubled with sin, well, you throw the first stone. Then he eyed them all. And they probably thought, oh, I don't think I like this. So beginning with the eldest, they went away because they didn't want to be exposed. She's the only one left. He says, there's no one condemning. And she says, no. And she says, look at that. I do not condemn you. This is God speaking. This is who God really is. I don't condemn you. Brackets. I love you. So go and don't sin anymore. He doesn't say it's not sin. Of course it's sin. It's a mess. The woman's in a bad place for hundreds of reasons. Some of her fault, some of other people's fault. We don't know and don't have to judge. But Jesus isn't condemning her, but he's loving her so that she doesn't need to do it anymore. And we don't know what happened, but I can hardly imagine. I think she would have been over the moon with it. The love of the heart of Jesus is the love given to Jesus by God. God is the source of love and the only source of love. God's the source of everything. Love is what God is. So if there's any love in your life, that's where it comes from. It's this love that was poured into the heart of Jesus that is poured into our hearts, as Paul tells us, by the gift of the Spirit. And it's this love that overflows from our hearts to embrace our brothers and sisters. We're not the source of love. God is. And he'll love through you in a tiny, gentle way if you're a piccolo. And he'll love through you in a loud way if you're a French horn. And he'll love you through you in a delicate way if you're a harp. And he'll love through you probably even with a trumpet. What I mean is, whoever we are, we've got our gift to offer. As Paul writes, God's love has been poured into our hearts through the Holy Spirit who has been given to us.